All right, testing, 1, 2, 3. Testing, 1, 2, 3. Want to make sure it's loud enough so you can hear me and that we get started on time. I need every minute I can get. Thank you for being here this morning. And it is 9 o'clock. Let's begin our class. Let's bow for a word of prayer, please. Our good Father, we offer thanks for this beautiful morning, for the presentation of your power and majesty all about us. We ask you to bless our time together today as we look into the evidences of your natural world. And we pray, our God, by the time we have finished our time together at this hour, that we'll be better able to glorify and magnify you as the creator of this universe and all that is in it. We thank you for the privilege in Jesus' holy name. Amen. For those of you visiting with us this month, we've been answering some special questions that people might ask you in the world. One of those questions is it reasonable to believe in a creator in this modern day? So I have titled it, as you see on the screen, Origins: Is It Reasonable to Believe in God in This Scientific Age? And I can tell you there are lots of people who would say, no, it is unreasonable to believe in God. Because the more we learn from science, the less is the need for God. Because we come to a better understanding of the world. And by the way, most of the need for God was to fill in the gaps of our lack of understanding. And therefore, the answer would be, no, it is not reasonable. And I could read you lots of documents to that effect. Rather than do that, I want to turn to why I believe the answer is yes. And I hope I've done a reasonable job by the time we finish. So, let's see if I can get... Let's first of all look at a scripture, Romans chapter 1 and verse 20. If there is a theme verse in the Bible for this type of a lesson this morning, this is it. There are numerous messages in the scriptures that tell the same thing, as for example Psalm 19, which says the heavens declare the glory of God and the firmament shows his handiwork. Those passages in the Old Testament clearly indicate that we can look at the natural world and see evidence of the God who made it. But Romans, the first chapter, is the theme passage. Verse 20, it says, "For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." What this passage teaches is you can see the invisible by seeing the evidence of it. So you're looking at things that are made, and you're concluding that there must be a maker. And what that is, class, is that is the design argument. And in my talks that I give about this subject, that is the argument I use. The argument from design. The design argument fundamentally says what Romans 1:20 says. By examining the things that are made, you can conclude the attributes of the maker. And in this case, an eternally powerful maker. Bible students are well familiar with this. I like to start with that because for the rest of my time today, we're not going to use this book. Please don't take offense at that. This is a Bible class. So why are we not using the Bible? Because I'm convinced the Bible teaches God has another book. And it is to that we will turn our attention now. This book says God has another book. So I hope everybody's awake and alert this morning. I don't allow sleeping in my class. And we're going to do science. We're going to look at the evidence of the natural world, which is a grand testimony to the one who made it. So let's begin. Say it again. No math. No, absolutely not. No, that is not so. We will be doing some math as well. I'm sorry to tell you. So let's begin with this probably most famous picture ever made. The title of this picture is Earthrise. So listen closely. On Christmas Eve, 1968, raise your hand if you were alive. Thank you. You make me feel better. Apollo 8 astronauts Frank Borman, James Lovell, and William Anders became the first human beings to see the far side of the moon. The moment was as historic as it was perilous. They had been wrested from Earth's gravity and hurled into space by the massive, barely tested Saturn V rocket. You remember this class that had your hands up a while ago? Although one of their primary tasks was to take pictures of the moon and search for future landing sites, the first lunar landing would take place just 7 months later. This is Christmas Eve, 1968. 7 months later, we landed on the moon. Many associate their mission with a different photograph, commonly called Earthrise. You see it before you. Emerging from the moon's far side during their fourth orbit, the astronauts were suddenly transfixed by their vision of Earth, a delicate, gleaming swirl of blue and white, contrasting with a monochromatic, barren lunar surface. You surely know that that's the moon, and that's the Earth. And it was a transforming picture. To mark this event's significance and its occurrence on Christmas Eve, the crew had decided after much deliberation to read the following words. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The reading and the reverent silence that followed went out over a live telecast to an estimated 1 billion viewers, the largest single audience in television history. Things have changed since 1968, haven't they? The reaction to this picture was different between the three men. Frank Borman and James Lovell became stronger believers that there is a God and openly expressed that. William Anders, on the other hand, became a stronger disbeliever. Same evidence, different reactions. William Anders said, look at that little blue spot in the middle of all this nothingness. I see no evidence of God out here. It's a lonely speck. Lovell and Borman, on the other hand, said, look at what surely God must have prepared as our place to live. You see, we can have different reactions to the same evidence, partly depending on our mindset. Now, this one isn't going to show up very well, and neither is the next one. Tell you what, guys, if you could at least shut down all the lights up there on the stage, that would be a help. I wish we could snap our fingers and darken this whole room, because I'd like for you to be able to see a little better. Well, that's good. That helps a little bit. The Voyager 1 spacecraft was sent into space in 1990. And its object was to take off through the solar system and continue on as far as it could go and then take pictures and send them back to Earth. The picture I'm going to show you next was from the Voyager spacecraft taken 4 billion miles away from Earth. Let's see if you can see anything. Well, you can see the arrow, which wasn't in the picture but was imposed. At the tip end of that arrow is a small blue dot. That, ladies and gentlemen, is a picture of us, our Earth, from 4 billion miles away. And it became the title of a famous book by Carl Sagan called The Pale Blue Dot. I read you a paragraph from his book. Because of the reflection of sunlight, Earth seems to be sitting in a beam of light, as if there were some special significance to this small world. But it's just an accident of geometry and optics. our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in this universe, are challenged by this point of pale blue light. Our planet is a lonely speck in a great enveloping cosmic dark. In our obscurity, in all of this vastness, there is no hint that help will come from somewhere else to save us from ourselves. Are you sufficiently depressed? Carl Sagan absolutely believed there was no evidence for God, and had the most popular television program of scientific content ever been on television, the Cosmos series, you remember? And one of his early statements was, the cosmos is all there is, all there ever was, or all there ever will be. That's his perception. And the pale blue dot in his mind didn't help it any. The common perception in our age, beloved, is that we are not very special, nor is the place where we live. In fact, since Copernicus basically undid the geocentric theory, which said the Earth sits at the middle of the universe and everything else revolves around it, may I ask, is there anyone in this room that still believes that? Thank you for not raising your hand. The evidence of the physical world does not support the notion that the Earth sits in the middle, motionless, and everything else revolves around us. That was the common perception for centuries, even millennia, until Copernicus and those after him. Nobody believes that anymore that looks at the evidence of the natural world. And so the perception then became, it even came to be labeled a Copernican principle, that we're rather mediocre. We're just one little speck in this vast universe, of which there surely must be many others much like us. And if we think that our civilization is something special, we're not paying attention. The notion then in the 50s and 60s that came to be very common, that life has evolved in many places in the universe, came to be widely accepted, and the notion was presented to those of us who were in college in those days. You better get over this belief in God, because it won't be long before we understand exactly how life came about without God. And then where will you be? So the question is, the more we've learned since those early days of discovery, is it reasonable to still believe in God? Lots of people say no. Let's see. I thought you would like the math, Kelly. When I was at Harvard University in 1967-68, I took a course in astronomy from one of the leading radio astronomers in the world, and one of the things they were looking for was intelligent life in the universe. Sagan and Schlosky wrote a book called Intelligent Life in the Universe. It was required reading in that class. And it is full of notes about why we think there is and how we can go about finding such people or such whoever they are. And this was the theme of the day. That's why not long after that the movie E.T. came out. Everybody remember that one? Extraterrestrial, and the search continues to the present time. Francis Drake made some effort at guessing how many civilizations there might be in our own Milky Way galaxy that are probably more advanced than ours. And so you can see here some of the factors he plugged in. If N is the number of communicating civilizations in our galaxy, what are some of the factors? Well, first, the number of stars, which is 200 billion. Fraction of stars suitable for life, pure guess, Fraction of suitable stars with planets, pure guess. Average number of habitable planets or moons per solar system, etc., etc. Look, they multiply all those factors together, and what they came up with, somewhere between 5 times 10 to the minus 7, which is essentially zero, or 750,000. And the conclusion of Carl Sagan and numerous others was, there are probably millions of civilizations more advanced than ours in the Milky Way galaxy. That's just our little place, folks. So that was the common conception. And that's why we spent millions of dollars in tax money searching for them in the SETI program. After 25 years of finding exactly nothing, they stopped using your tax money. That's one of the few things where they ever stopped using your tax money. They're still looking, however, using private funding every day, you can be assured. They're looking for evidence of intelligent life somewhere else. Well, Drake's equation has been modified now. There's probably 10 other factors that have been plugged in there. In fact, if you really thought about Drake's equation carefully, you'd come up with many other factors that impact the question. Is there other intelligent life somewhere in the universe? So, here we are, ladies and gentlemen, about 60 years later than the events I described to you earlier. And where are we? Rather than the book Intelligent Life in the Universe by Sagan, which basically propounded there's everywhere and there's lots of them because evolution is surely easy to take place. Now we have books like this one, put out by evolutionists, ladies and gentlemen. These are not believers in God. And the title of their book is Rare Earth. And the subtitle is Why Complex Life is Uncommon in the Universe, says Peter Ward and Donald Brownlee. And I can assure you there are numbers of publications like this one that have come out in the last 10 to 15 years where people are now saying, well, after further consideration, it may be that our little place in the universe, small and insignificant as it is, may be very rare. In fact, there may not be another one. And such conclusions are being said by some folks who accept the evolutionary view of life. Rare Earth is one of those. Here's another very interesting book that I'm going to use a good bit today. It's called The Privileged Planet. In fact, I was reading from it when we read about the moon event. And here's what these men, Gonzalez and Richards, say at the conclusion of their book. It appears that Earth is pretty privileged. You know, one of the things about the Copernican principle is we're not privileged. We're average and mediocre. There's nothing special about us. Well, I can tell you the more we're learning about our universe, the more privileged we're looking. And I want to say this now lest I forget later. We have been removed from the center of the universe as a moveless object surrounded by everything else. And thus the focus of God's attention. That's how it was looked upon. And if you look at ancient paintings, you'll see the earth drawn as sitting still and everything else around it. And the heavens, God peeping through openings to watch us. Well, that perception's gone based on physical evidence. But here's what we're finding, class. We're finding that while we're not sitting at the center of the universe, it appears that this little place may be the only place like it in the entire universe. And that's my lesson for today. I want to explain to you why we're beginning to think that. Think I can do that in the time I have? It's going to be challenging. The very same rare properties that allow for our existence also provide the best overall setting to make discoveries about the world around us. That's what Privileged Planet's all about. They say the same properties that allow us to be here allow us to have the best place that appears in the universe to make observations. It doesn't mean we can make them all, but it appears it's the optimal place. That's why they're calling it the Privileged Planet. It's a fascinating story. And by the way, Guillermo Gonzalez, who's an astronomer at Iowa State University, was literally crucified for daring to say such a thing. His fellow teachers of that school didn't want him getting tenure or being recognized because he dared to suggest there might be a plan behind all this in the privileged planet. Now, there's a third book I want to recommend to you. And if any of you really want to dig in, you can come later and get the actual references. The Privileged Planet, The Rare Earth, and this one called God's Crime Scene by J. Wallace Warner. J. Wallace Warner is a cold case detective. You know what that is? That's somebody that takes a case that has gotten cold and tries to uncover the evidence and solve the case. He was raised by a family of atheists. They are still atheists. He wrote this book partly to help his dad be convinced there really is a God, because he has become convinced. And he's done it based on the use of the techniques of a cold case detective. Now, I need just a little bit of light right in here, if you would, so I can do a little bit of sharing with you here. A cold case detective examines the evidence for a divinely created universe. And here's one of the things that he says in his book. Of course, he quotes from a number of other folks. There's the Goldilocks enigma. Now, children, help me with Goldilocks. Goldilocks went out into the woods, right? And where did she go? Help me quickly. She went to a bear's house. In fact, there were how many bears? Three bears. And she went inside, and the first thing she did was try some porridge. And Daddy Bear's porridge was, say it loud, too hot. Mama Bear's was too cold, and Baby Bear's was just right, and she ate it all up. That's the Goldilocks story. How do we apply that to this? In the Goldilocks Enigma, a book by Paul Davies, a thoroughgoing evolutionist, he argues it appears that life is just right. I mean, the universe is just right to support life here on Earth. That's a strange thing. It's even been given a name. It's called the anthropic principle. Anthropos is the Greek word for human beings. It appears, ladies and gentlemen, that there are factors in the universe that appear to be fine-tuned to allow life to exist here on Earth. That's what this man is investigating with his evidence-based technique. And so he's looking at evidence for interference in this universe to design it. One of the most significant facts, arguably the most significant fact about the universe, is that we are a part of it. Did you ever think about that? The fact that there are living human beings in the universe is absolutely astounding. Why is that? It's a good question. Everyone agrees that the universe looks as if it was designed for life. Listen, you're not going to find argument about that, even among the evolutionists. It sure looks like it. Now, they turn right around and say, oh, it only looks like it. It's not real. It all came about by natural causes. And so I'm going to test your faith. That's what I want to do. It looks as if our universe is spectacularly fine-tuned for life, says J. Leslie in his 1996 book, The Universes. By this I mean only that it looks as if small changes in the universe's basic features would have made life's evolution impossible. You change a number of things just a little teeny-nicey bit, and they're not just right. And life would never have happened, nor continued. That's what these gentlemen are saying. Now, you see, they're very careful to say, it looks like it. They don't really believe it. So now let me read you just a little piece out of this God's Crime Scene. Because the fact is, he talks about a case in each of his chapters. The question in this case is, there are two dead people. How'd they get dead? Was it a natural occurrence? or was there tampering from the outside? That's the question. Helen knew something was wrong when her daughter Carrie failed to answer the door. It was a bright summer afternoon. Carrie said she'd be home. Her car was indeed parked in the driveway. Helen tried to peek in through the living room window, but the curtains were drawn unusually. Carrie never locked the back door, but when Helen walked into the backyard of the old home, she found the door locked and all the windows closed. That was not like Carrie. She usually left one badly worn rear window slightly ajar. Helen began to panic. She told Todd and Carrie that Todd and Carrie had a tumultuous marriage, one that included physical violence. Todd had moved out. Helen still feared for her daughter's safety. The couple had a child named Lexi, but the violence had only intensified since her birth. A week ago, Todd had threatened to kill Carrie, and just last night, Carrie confided there'd been another fight. Would you say those are all circumstances that impact the way you think about this? When Helen couldn't get Carrie to answer the door on this afternoon, she decided to call the police. Now, I'm going to skip the reading here. The police came. They smelled gas, so they called the fire department. They went in and investigated. They found the folks dead on the second floor. Lots of pieces of information given in the process. Carrie and Lexi were dead. Natural event? Or was there tampering? It was a cold case by the time he got on it. And he began investigating. Fascinating story. Disgusting. But I can tell you, Todd was convicted of first-degree murder based on the series of evidences. In the investigation, they looked at foundational, regional, and locational conditions that demanded explanation. What did the thing need to explain? Why are there two dead bodies? His argument, when you're looking at the origin of the universe, is why are there live bodies on earth? He said we need to look at foundational, regional, and locational evidence and treat them the same way you would in a case like this and see what conclusions we draw. That's what this book is about. I hope you'll read it. It'll be fascinating reading. I'm going to share with you just a few things that point to why we should believe there's been outside tampering in this universe. It's the anthropic principle. In the 1960s, when I was in college, scientists had discovered two characteristics of the cosmos that were fine-tuned and 8 to 10 of the solar system that were fine-tuned. That was just the beginning. So young people, listen to me. We're always learning more stuff. Don't you be scared about science. You get in there and jump in there with them and learn everything you can. I thought when I was in college, if I jumped in too deeply to the sciences, I would lose my faith in God. And 50 years later, I have stronger faith than I've ever had. And it's partly based on the evidence of the natural world, which has become so overwhelming in the last 50 years. So at that time, there were 2 and 8 to 10. By the 2000s, scientists had discovered 38 characteristics of the cosmos recognized as fine-tuned for physical life, and over 150 in our solar system that are required to support human life. The evidence has multiplied, ladies and gentlemen of the jury. And part of my goal today is to just throw the evidence before you, and then I'm going to ask you, can you, in your heart of hearts, believe that all of these factors that are necessary to support human life all came about by coincidental forces of nature acted upon by natural selection, which is the fundamental picture presented now? I have to confess, I have trouble having such faith. So here we go. You ready? And I'm going to have to really watch my time here, so we're going to skip around. But please believe me, every point I'm about to make should take a week. The strong nuclear force is one of those foundational factors of the universe that if it's not within a very narrow range, you would not be here. and the universe wouldn't be here. Nobody argues with this. What's the strong nuclear force? In the nucleus of an atom, all the protons are crammed together in almost no space. Help me, class. What are protons charged? Positive. All the positive charged particles are crammed into one space. What should happen when positive particles get close to each other? They'll expand and get away from each other. They don't. There is a tremendous force holding those nuclei particles together. It's called the strong nuclear force. If that strong nuclear force, according to the experts, would vary by one part in 10 to the 37th, we wouldn't have a universe. Now, that doesn't mean a thing to you, because it's math. So I'm going to help you a little bit. I want to give you some idea of what 1 to the 10 to the 37th is. Imagine covering the entire North American continent in dimes, stacking them until they reach the moon. Are you with me? Our whole continent stacked with dimes all the way to the moon. Now imagine stacking just as many dimes again on another billion continents the same size as North America. If you marked one of those dimes and hid it in the billions of piles you'd assembled, the odds of a blindfolded friend picking out the correct dime is approximately 1 in 10 to the 37th. The same level of precision required in the strong nuclear force. It has to be that precise, or you wouldn't be here. Did I get that across? I'm not quoting figures from Bible believers. These are evolutionists. This is a fact, ladies and gentlemen, best we can determine it. All right, there's the weak nuclear force. There's electromagnetic force. That's what holds atoms together. You remember atoms have positives and negatives, and the electrons are around the nucleus, and there are neutrons in the nucleus also, and then there are lots of other particles. There's a force, ladies and gentlemen, that holds those together. We've studied it extensively. It has to be within a very narrow range. Every one of these, I'm telling you, is of the similar nature to the one I just described. These are foundational facts. That's like when Helen drove up to the house and the curtains were closed. Or better yet, she knew in the background they'd been arguing and he threatened to kill his wife. Foundational factors. Gravitational force. You know, that's the force between objects with mass. We have measured that precisely, ladies and gentlemen. And there are factors related to the gravitational force that if they weren't precise, you wouldn't be here. The ratio of electrons to protons and the mass density of the universe. How many more of those are there? I told you there are 38 now that we know about. And I guarantee you the more we study, the more we're going to learn. That all have to be fine-tuned for life to exist, for the universe to exist. I express my apology to every one of these for the inadequate explanation I've just given. Now let's go to regional. There are regional fine-tuned factors that also have to be just right. What do I mean by regional? I'm talking about our galaxy. The Milky Way galaxy. Folks, not just any galaxy will support life. Did you know that? It has to be the proper type of galaxy. So there's the Hubble telescope. Can we get these lights off again now, quickly? If you haven't gone to your internet and looked at Hubble telescope pictures, you haven't lived. So get home and do it. Here's one picture taken by the Hubble telescope of the constellation Serpens, one portion of it. Is that amazing? Let me get my pointer here. I don't know how well you can see it, but you see all these big, those big, large blobs of light there? You say, isn't that amazing how many stars there are up there? What you don't realize is that most of those larger ones are not stars. Those are galaxies, each of which contains 200 billion stars. This is one little piece of one section of our universe. It's incredible how much is out there. But I will tell you, in the studies men have done, there's a limit to which galaxies can support life. Now you can have some lights back on if you would. The primary galaxies out there are called elliptical. Approximately 95% of all galaxies are elliptical. May I say to you, class, elliptical galaxies could never support a planetary system with life on it like we have. Period. So with one stroke of the pen, we've just eliminated 95% of all galaxies, of which we think there are billions. Irregular galaxies don't work either. They're too irregular. People do not believe irregular galaxies would support a life system like we have. There's another type called Seyfert galaxies. They blow up every now and then. Not real good for supporting living things. And then there's spiral galaxies. Folks, spiral galaxies are ideal for supporting a planetary system like ours in certain places. And guess what our Milky Way galaxy is? It's spiral. Well, an evolutionist would say, well, if that's the kind of galaxy you had to have for life to evolve, then this is the kind we had. It just happened that way. Okay? Now, you can accept that kind of reasoning for just so long. But it is true, our galaxy is a spiral galaxy, and it's relatively a small number of those in the universe. Less than 5%. But class and jury, it's not good enough to just have the right kind of galaxy. You have to be at the proper place in the galaxy. So if you look at our galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy from the side, you can see that it has a bulge right here. You could not have a planetary system anywhere near that. The planetary systems would have to be way out here on this end or way out here on this end. And we know precisely the percentage of the places in the spiral galaxy where a planetary system could exist. It's a very small percentage. So, class, I think I'm boring you a little bit. Don't you leave me. We've eliminated practically all galaxies, and within the small number of galaxies that are possibilities, we've eliminated most of the stars and space in those galaxies. You with me? Again, please, everything I'm saying, don't you accept it because I'm telling you. You go look for yourself. I'll give you the references if you like. This is not, can I say it, ignorant creationists saying all this. So it has to be at the proper place in the galaxy. It has to be the proper kind of star. Even if it's in the right place in the galaxy, class, it's not just any old star that's going to work here. So let's give you a little quick lesson here. Here's our sun relative to our planets. And you say, man, that sun is massive. And it is, compared to our planets. Here's Jupiter, here's the sun, here's our Earth right there. And you say, man, that's a massive star. No, it isn't. The sun is a relatively small star. If you compare it to Sirius, the dog star, and Pollux, and Arcturus. And by the way, Arcturus isn't half as big as Betelgeuse. Our sun is an average star, class. There are lots of stars smaller and lots of stars bigger. It's about an average star. An evolutionist says, well, that just illustrates how average we are. And that's the kind of star was needed, so that's the kind of star where life eventually appeared. Okay? And my question to you is, how many factors do you have to have before you say, that's getting a little hard to believe that it just happened by coincidences? You have to have the proper mass for your planet. Let's take a look at our planets again. And by the way, Pluto's back as a planet after the Pluto mission that I told you about not long ago. Well, so Jupiter and Saturn, they would not work for life. Are you kidding me? The more we learn about them, the less likely there is life to be there. Uranus and Neptune the same way. Earth is about the same size as Venus. Is anybody looking on Venus for life right now? No, where are they looking? Say it. Mars. Why are they not looking on Venus? Venus is much closer in size to the Earth. It's because Venus has an atmosphere of sulfuric acid. Not real habitable. And it rotates the wrong way, and it's got all kinds of other problems. So they're looking on Mars. And what are they looking for, class? For some T90 evidence that there might be life there. What are they looking for? Water. We'll get back to that in a minute. But the fact is, there's a very narrow range of mass for planets to allow them to support life. It's a very narrow range. In our solar system, it's 2, basically, out of 9. All right. Let's now talk about locational fine-tunes. Remember, it was foundational, regional, and locational. Now we're getting down to inside the bedroom. The planet has to be just the right distance from the sun. Do you notice the word just the right distance? That is called the habitable zone. Everybody knows what it is. It has to be the right distance from the sun. If you're too close, what happens? It's too hot, kids. If you're too far away, it's too cold. But if it's in the habitable zone, it's just right. Guess where Earth is? Right in the habitable zone. And of course, that's what had to be, so that's what happened. So they would say. It has to have the right spin. Do you realize how critical it is that Earth spins on its axis once every 365 plus days? Oh no, once every 24 hours, right? Pardon me. By the way, that rotation around the sun is pretty important too, which we're not even talking about. Well, you'll see in just a minute. It has to have the right tilt to support life. And by the way they say this is to support life as we know it. When anybody says that, people, just remember, we don't know any other kind of life but ours. Life as we know it suggests there might be other forms of life. Nobody knows anything about any other form of life than carbon, water-based life, period. The only form of life, I believe, in the universe. Can't prove that. It has to have the right tilt to support carbon water-based life. And you've probably seen this in your junior high science classes. The tilt helps give us what? The seasons. And a number of other things which we're not having time to talk about. Very important for supporting life. If that weren't within a very narrow range, class, that angle is about 27 degrees, I think. 23 and a half is what it is. You ought to get on your knees and thank God for 23 and a half. It has to have just right moon. Did you know that? Anybody know how many moons Pluto has? I'm not going to tell you. Go look. Saturn has a bunch. Jupiter has a bunch. We have one. And it's just right, class. And it affects 1,000 things. Give me one thing you know the moon affects on this earth. Say it louder. The tides, you can multiply your list. It has to have just the right atmospheric conditions. That's worth several classes. It has to have just the right terrestrial crust. Kids, quit tearing the crust off your peanut butter sandwiches. Crusts are important. The terrestrial crust is really important. And there are 140 more. Okay? That would take us the next 2 years. I want to say again, all of these have to be within a narrow range of variability or there would be no life and no place to put it. So the question is, can you really believe that all these fine-tuned factors all just came about by natural causes over millions of years, guided by natural selection, some inimical force that's almost God? And then there's water, my favorite substance, because it's chemistry again. And if you were in my chemistry class, we'd spend 6 weeks on this one substance. Did you know, class, that this is the most studied substance on the face of the earth to this day? Wouldn't you think we knew everything there was to know about water by now? No, we do not. There's still lots of study going on. about water. So this is a flash course. It covers 70% of the Earth's surface. On Mars, they're looking for some teeny-ninety possible bit of, there might be some somewhere. We're 70% water. Think that's an accident? Most plants and animals are 60% water by volume. So you are a waterhead, if that's what your brother called you. Watermelon's 98% water. That's pretty good, too. Water has a unique structure. It's 104.5 degree bond angle. It's absolutely critical to all of its properties. You can see here it's got a slightly negative end and a slightly positive end because of that angle. And listen to me, class. If we didn't have water the way it is, you wouldn't be here. So I'm going to flash through some of its properties. It's the only substance on Earth that exists in all three states. It's uniquely high specific heat. It's a temperature range for liquid of 0 to 100. That's amazing. It's less dense as a solid. You drank tea last night? The solid water was at the top, wasn't it? You realize how important that is? If you weren't that way, you'd be dead. The fact that solid water is less dense is incredible. There are very few substances on Earth where the solid is less dense than the liquid. Water happens to have that property. I think it was designed. It's a universal solvent. It has high surface tension, cohesion, and adhesion. And I would say to you, class, apologize for the brevity, but I hope I overwhelmed you, ladies and gentlemen in the jury, that there are hundreds and hundreds of factors that all have to be fine-tuned within a very narrow range in order for you to be here. And the evidence is piling up. They're in another place in the entire universe that has all those factors. I would say that argues for a designer who had a plan in mind and who is focusing his attention on this light, pale blue dot. Because it's the only place there are beings like us in His image. And even if it isn't, there's still something so special about this place. It sets it apart. So why would I think it's reasonable to believe in God in the scientific age? Because everywhere you look, from the macroscopic to the microscopic, things sure look like they're made. Or were designed, says Michael Behe in his good book, Darwin's Black Box. A loud, clear, piercing cry of design everywhere you look makes me think the most logical explanation is there's a designer. And it's more reasonable than ever to believe that there is. You were really a good listening class. Thank you very much. Our time is up. Let's be